I want to be stereotyped. I want to be classified.
Listening to Stumptown Trade Review, a special interview with Jamie Rich. I'm Brian.
And I'm Thor.
And I'm Jamie.
And so we are here today talking with Jamie about his latest book, You Have Killed Me, coming out from Oni Press July 15th, I believe.
Yeah, thereabouts. It should be at some point around July 15th. It's always sort of questionable when it hits the shops versus once it hits Diamond, but it's on its way.
All right. So this is a detective noir story set in the, 1930s, 1940s? It's kind of vague as to when it's set.
Yeah, we partially did that on purpose just to sort of create. We were basically looking at an old Hollywood atmosphere. If we had to nail it down, I think we kind of looked at it as 1938, at least based on the cars we used and other elements like that. And it gets a little more, in planning for maybe doing some future stuff with this character, it gets a little more nailed down, so 38 has become pretty much the year.
Okay. So where is the genesis of You Have Killed Me? Where did you come about with this story and, the characters that inhabit this world?
It started with just sort of this idea that I wanted to work with Joelle again while we were in the middle of doing 12 Reasons Why I Love Her. And my spidey sense was tingling that, she was going to become very popular very quickly, which turned out to be true. So I was and I already knew that particularly guys in my position, other indie comics writers, were, going to smell the blood in the water because all of us are always looking for artists. So I'm like, I want to nail you down now for a second book. I didn't want anybody get time to get in and take her. So I asked her basically, what do you want to do next? Because she came to 12 Reasons, it was done, and it was a project just needing an artist. So I wanted to do something more collaborative. And she said what she always wanted to draw was an old school private detective, hard-boiled story. I am a huge film noir fan and had never really thought about doing that kind of material because I'm sort of the mind of if you love it too much, it's a little scary to step into it. Who am I to do these things that I admire? But I decided to take that challenge, and it just sort of began with trying to figure out who the detective himself would be and the basic kind of guy I wanted him to be, and using that notion of the private detective as this existential hero who stands for something in a world where maybe values are falling apart, where other people don't have the same sort of moral code. As Chandler, I think, was the one who described him in the Big Sleep as Philip Marlowe as being like a knight out of time, the last of the Knights Templar, the last of this code of chivalry. And so that was sort of something I've always worked with, I think, anyway, in my more romantic books and my prose as well. So I decided that I discovered basically that what was already my typical main character fit perfectly within this kind of genre. And so it sort of just reverberated from that.
You talk about being, a film noir fan, and reading through your blog, you also do a lot of DVD reviews, and you go back and look at a lot of the classic movies and movies that might have been overlooked throughout time. What kind of films and filmmakers were influencing you when you were writing this and doing your research for a film noir detective story?
The two biggest ones right off the bat, and which was a kind of how I... I usually don't try to do that sort of Hollywood pitch thing, but I had this sort of basic idea of, I started to describe the book as Michelangelo Antonioni directs The Big Sleep. And so part of the concept of the mystery in the book kind of was borrowed from La Ventura, where in that movie, that Antonioni movie, this woman disappears from an island that her and her fiance and her sister have gone out to on this boat. There's no village there. Nobody lives there. It's just a rocky crag in the middle of the water. Only one boat. Where did she go? And so I kind of ganked that by making it in the book. Well, this woman disappeared from a locked bathroom. There's no windows. There's one person outside the door. Where did she go? And use that as my sort of way to bend the genre to something I was comfortable with that was different enough to feel like me. And so that was definitely in my mind. And I think that's sort of where some of the narration element came out, this idea that the narration is, instead of being about what's actually happening, is going to be these outside thoughts that the main character is having. And then, of course, The Big Sleep and Maltese Falcon, which is directed by John Huston, those are kind of my basic models for what this type of character would be like. I was also watching a lot of Jules Dassin, particularly the stuff that he made when he had to flee the country because of the McCarthy hearings. So he went to England and he made Night in the City. And just before that, actually, he made this really great movie called Thieves Highway about a truck driver in San Francisco and smuggling. And so that was also in there a lot. And Out of the Past by Jacques Tenor. I think some noir fans will be able to find little Easter eggs that I put throughout, like names and things that I borrowed for locations to evoke certain movies and certain books as well.
Well, there was also the book that Mercer picks up when looking through, was it The Wheel Turns?
Yeah,
that was another big sort of hint and clue as to what was, or not necessarily a hint or clue, but one of those Easter eggs there as well.
I was curious if anybody was going to pick that up because... That is actually the book that The Lady Vanishes was based on. So I've been waiting to see if someone would actually say it. So you win the prize for being the first one to notice that. So
sorry if I ruined it for anybody else. But no, keep an eye out because there are lots of little pokes here and there and lots of things. And Out of the Past really was one that stuck out for me because that is sort of the prototypical noir detective story, which you got the voiceover and the right. Dame and all these other things coming in, which brings me to the next point is that, you touched on the idea of having this sort of be a timeless character and be something that you felt that you could relate to and you could be comfortable being a part of. How did you settle on sort of the pacing of the characterization and the dialogue so that what came out was something that was believable for the time period, but also played well in a modern day? Because it's a fine line between it being sort of noir dialogue and then just sort of being that over-the-top, right, almost parody of it.
Yeah, I think part of that was why I didn't want to do the straightforward narration, because it's so easy to become cliche in that element, and having your detective describe every move and describe everybody he sees, and she was a dame, and like a dame that would make a priest kick out a window, I think it was one of like the old Chandler lines. But so that was part of getting into it, and I just kind of trusted my ear and trusted that Joelle would keep me from going over the top. It's always that element of trying restraint in everything you do, of what can you remove and trying not to overdo it. So I don't think that I sat too dogmatically and thought about it. I just kind of let it flow. And for me, in the back of my mind, it was more, I need to live up to this tradition. I need to at least not embarrass myself. I know I can't beat these guys. I can't do better than they can. So how can I just fit in as best as possible? And so I think that philosophy as well becomes the, it kept me from wanting to stand out. So it kept me from going too far with it.
So why do you think that the detective noir story plays so well in 2009? I mean, you said this was set roughly in 1938, so here we are 70 years removed. Why does it play so well now?
I think particularly in a lot of like the political climate of the last 9 years since, the 21st century has been this idea that there have been things going on that maybe not enough people have been paying attention to and not enough people have been looking at or asking the questions. And the detective is always that character, the guy that won't stop asking the questions no matter how many people tell him, get out of this, leave it alone. He keeps going forward. And I think that that character always has a certain resonance because there's always going to be situations where somebody has to stand up and say, this isn't right. This needs to be addressed. Let's take care of it. And so for me, I think that has a very strong resonance. And like I said, it's that character who follows a code and sticks to it. And I think for me personally, I feel like that's something everybody should have, like your boundaries, what you think is right, and you should follow that as best you can. And then there's also the elements, there is the personal elements within it, the relationships, and I think there's a great, just like science fiction has always been a great vehicle for commenting on modern times through using futuristic elements as allegory, I think doing stuff in the past and working with older genres has the same possibility. It speaks to something in people without being so dogmatically, this is right now and this is you. It transports it while it entertains and while it informs.
So, excuse me, you mentioned before working with Joelle Jones on the art with 12 Reasons Why I Love You.
Love her, yeah.
Love her. And wanting to tie her up and get her back to work on this again. That was one of the first things that Thor and I really just popped, even before we got rolling in the story, was the art and how immensely layered it was with textures and all. Can you just comment a little bit on the art and how, you know, you guys collaborated on that?
Yeah, largely, I mean, we collaborated mostly in the scripting stage where I would tell her what I was working on and she would give me feedback and suggestions. So she'd suggest certain things that she wanted to draw. And so there was a lot of points in the book where I was basically catering the writing to either knowing she would like to draw something like the horse races or feeling like she could draw this really, really well. And so in my head, seeing things like, oh, that'd be so cool if she drew this. From there, so much of it was, once the script was done, she just sort of ran with it. I mean, she did all the tones by hand. It's old-fashioned Zipatone. No digital work at all within the book. There are certain visual elements that I suggested in the script. I think we came up with the concept of using some of the blurry effects together. It's the only time she used new technology was just using, did something with her printer or with a Xerox machine to make it blurry. And then I think it was even in the script, there's a point where you see Mercer driving his car and there's a photocopy of an actual Los Angeles street from the 30s behind him. And I think in the script I suggested like we should do something like a rear projection in an old movie. And that worked out really, really well. And there are stuff that I thought was really tricky. Like there's a whole sequence near the end where a lot of it is happening in darkness, to where where I basically said like, okay, if you think this is gonna look cheesy, like if it's being gimmicky, then let's drop it. But I think she figured out how to do that really, really well by using the stark black and white and making it look blown out, since it's a lot of flashlight element that bring in the light source. So. What I really like about her stuff that I think came out in this and I'm starting to see in her newer work is using background detail for emotion. There's also a point in the book where there's like a fire behind a character and it's actually just in the fireplace, but the way she draws it, it looks like it's about to engulf the room and it sort of matches his rage. And I see her doing more and more stuff like that, more and more designy elements, because she's working on a new book for Vertigo. That I'm seeing her add so much of that kind of thing to the background. It's almost starting to remind me a little bit of J.H. Williams and what he's doing. And I'm not even sure she's actually read any of his stuff, but she's just incredible. So,
well, and that was the other thing about the art was that, like the writing, it's so easy to go into the cliches. It's easy to throw a long shadow up or something like that to say, hey, look, this is a noir story. And she avoided that. but at the same time, through the toning, was able to bring back, you know, those wool suits and, yeah, you know, all the styles of the 30s so well.
And she's incredibly good researcher, so she was finding all these cars and buildings to borrow from, and I mean her swipe file is probably amazing, because she, most of these buildings in here, she found period structures that she could work off of. And same thing when she did Token, she had to draw a 1980s Florida, and so she really got into doing that and actually discovered the great tool of Google Maps. Because you can, and I've used it since when I was writing about places I hadn't been. You can get on Google and then walk right down the street and pick up all these details. So I was writing a scene in Spain and was able to go to the big sort of touristy area in Spain, look around and see that High School Musical apparently is a very popular play over there.
So you mentioned that there is the possibility of a return for Mercer, the main character. What kinds of things are you working on, either with him just sort of bopping around in your brain, or, you know, what other projects are you working on now?
Right now we haven't set down any schedule for a second book with Mercer. I kind of have in my brain the idea of doing about 5 volumes if we get the chance, which could grow. So I know what at least the second and the third book probably will be, but not sure when we'll get to them. And I kind of want to see just him as a character. A lot of the philosophy now of how I'm approaching the character was based on a point in the book when Joel, we see one flashback in this book, and there's lots of hints to his past as a rich kid who now is no longer part of that and is somehow denying where he came from. Mm-hmm. And there's a flashback where you see him and he's being somewhat meek. And Joel was curious about that. Like, why is he such a wuss in this flashback, and now he's such a hard guy? And so I kind of felt like I want to go from that and watch him get harder and maybe start trying to break down what his code would be, and how he loses more and more of his sort of compassion towards the world as he sees how dark it gets. But not sure when we get to that. Joelle's got a couple of projects she's working on that I believe will be announced shortly. Stuff that I think will come out of San Diego. And we have a book with Oni that we co-created, and she's doing covers and flashbacks for. We borrowed the structure from a book that I edited at Oni called Hopeless Savages, where flashbacks were always drawn by somebody else. And working with an artist in France named Nicolas Hattori Day, who is going to do the main story. And it's called Spell Checkers. It's like a sort of comedy about 3 witches in high school. And it's my kind of concept was like I wanted to do like that classic Mean Girls, Heathers type story, but I didn't want to have the good girl. Like, it's like that just gets in the way and forces everybody to learn a lesson. I was like, this, I wanted to adopt the Seinfeld philosophy and like, no hugs, no learning. Let's just stick with all the bad stuff. So that was really fun to write. And again, stretching and learning how to do a different genre. And so I got to write comedy, which I was always kind of scared of, because it's hard to be funny on purpose. So we're working on that right now. And I think we're seeing about an early 2010 release for that. And we've got other ideas in the works. I mean, I've actually got a script done for Joel that I need to sort of find a venue for. And we just had our Madman story come out. We did a half an issue of Madman Atomic Comics, and that was the most recent work we've done. I think we only finished that like 2 months ago, so it was pretty fast coming out. So you'll see work from both of us, I think, separately before you'll see a longer work from us again.
All right. You know, before I sign off and end this, you know, one of the, and I'm going out of order here, so to get back really quick to the story, one of the recurring thoughts or themes that keeps coming back is this idea of the toasted almonds and how Mercer's grandfather tried to get him tried to teach him how to roast almonds. And then this metaphor just keeps coming back and back and back. And that was one that it sort of stuck out for both of us, and we were just curious where that came from, if that was something that you had pulled from your own life or where this idea had come from, because it is something very unique there.
I think it started just with the idea that there should be, with the sense memory at the beginning of the book, where he smells the smell of almonds and he thinks it's the girl that he's actually being hired to look for, which is his ex-fiancée, and it's her, and instead it's her little sister. And throughout the book, he smells that and thinks he's smelling the perfume of the girl he's looking for. And I chose almonds because, one, I like the smell, but two, it also is a smell that's associated with poison. Cyanide, it smells like bitter almonds. And so I figured that would be one of those, little details that could evoke certain reactions within the readers who might pick up on that. So that was really where that all came from. And then from that, this idea of the burning the almonds, just became within that. You can mess things up even further. I approached a lot of that kind of two narration very much like the character, where I let it be stream of conscious. In fact, when I read over the book to proof the lettering, I was kind of surprised by how linear his narration is, because I don't recall writing it in like big chunks like that. I did have these big gaps in between, but it seemed to work. Though I did find it recently on my hard drive, a whole narrative scene that I didn't use that I forgot about. So there were times where I would just write a monologue and then break it up throughout the book.
All right. Well, thank you very much for sitting down with us. Once again, the book is You Have Killed Me, coming out from Oni Press, hopefully July 15th-ish. And you will be at San Diego Comic Con, as will Joelle.
Yeah, and the book. Yeah, we'll both be there, and the book is going to be there as well. Like, they told us for sure that we will have a couple cases of the book to sell. So we'll be sitting at the Oni table, and I'm sure we'll have a schedule closer to the date on either of our blogs or the Oni website.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to Stumptown Trade Review.
To be classified.